Okay, good evening, everybody, again. It'd be great if people moved up to this end of the room because it looks a bit, doesn't it, daunting. So thank you to everyone who's still here. It's been a long day, but we are now in for a treat, I think. I'm delighted to introduce to you at the end of our day the poet Dhearani Grifa on behalf of the School of English at Maynooth University and my own institute. Professor Colin Graham was originally supposed to introduce Dhearan, but he was taken away for a surprise trip to Paris for a big birthday, so we'll excuse him. So I'm afraid I'm no literary critic, but I'm going to do my best to introduce Dhearan and her work in Colin's absence. And I want to thank as well Una Frawley for her support around this section of the evening as well. Dhearani Grifa has published widely in literary magazines in Ireland and abroad, such as Poetry, The Irish Times, The Examiner, Prairie Schooner, The Stinging Fly, Southward, and Festa. In 2012, her poem Fáin Leoga won the Wigtown Award for Poetry written in Scottish Gaelic. She has received a number of awards and bursaries. She's received two literature bursaries from the Arts Council of Ireland in 2011 and 2013. She was selected for the prestigious Ireland Chair of Poetry Bursary Award. And in 2016, her recent book, Clasp, which I brought along a copy of and which can be ordered online, Clasp was shortlisted for the Irish Times Poetry Now Award, the National Poetry Prize of Ireland. So we're deeply honoured, Dhearan, that you're here with us this evening. Most significantly, in 2017, she was awarded the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature, which is a marvellous and a richly deserved achievement. As I said, I'm no literary critic, but I would include among the poems by Dhearan which have most touched me the poem she wrote in response to the death of Savita Halappanavar. Likewise, living on Military Hill, her poems written from Richmond Hill, and I know some people who live near Richmond Hill or are here, have resonated very strongly with me and other people who live in the area. As we were just discussing after Alva McDade's paper, the poet's intervention is something we badly need in contemporary Ireland, and women especially need this in Ireland. I feel very fortunate to have gotten to know Dhearan in Cork, where I worked in UCC for nearly 20 years. Dhearan read at the Merryman Summer School the year I was director of it in 2015, having just given birth to her little girl, Leisha. Cork is, of course, a vibrant city for writers and poets, but in particular, I think it's a special place and space for na mBunófh Uile. As well as being an exceptional poet, Dhearan is an exceptional person in so many ways, and I feel very proud to know her as a friend and indeed as a fellow revolutionary in keeping with our theme of today. So I ask you to warmly welcome Dhearani Grifa to read here this evening.
I'm delighted to be here this evening, and thanks a million to Linda and to Colin Graham for arranging for me to be here. And I must say it's such a bonus that my reading was scheduled for 1 o'clock. That's just perfect timing for poetry. So I'm going to start with one poem that was published in a little book last year. I was commissioned to write like a series of poems and a piece of fiction and things like that, honouring the centenary of the proclamation. And I'm always curious about when you have an established text and you take a little scissors to it, there's often something else hiding inside it. And several different people could pursue that and find something different hiding inside the same original text. So this text within a text is what I found when I came to the proclamation. And it speaks To Irish women. To Ireland, Irish women. She receives through us her children and her freedom. Her secret through her open, and she now seizes her own strength, asserted in the arms of every Irish woman. We place blessings upon our arms, and we pray supreme readiness for the common good, worthy of all. Linda mentioned Richmond Hill, and that was a place that I lived in a tiny up-to-down house in the years when we had our first children, and it was a very special time in my life. And that place has become kind of mythic in my writing. It's strange when you come to a place as an adult and you're rearing children there. Particularly with Cork, it's such a particular place. Trying to rear children is like year of Cork. It's very challenging. Especially my husband's family are so Cork, so I put my foot in it a lot. But this poem speaks to that experience. It's called From Richmond Hill. Home from hospital, you doze in my arm, milk drunk, all eyelashes, cheeks and raw umbilical, swaddled in the heavy black smells of the brewery. Your great-grandfathers worked all their lives in that factory. Every day they were there, breathing the same air, hoisting barrels, sweating over vats where black bubbles rose like fat. At dusk, they poured into pubs and ordered porter. Neat black pints lidded with white silk, thick as cream from frothing milk. And their replies were always the same, the gasp, the nod. Down gullets and guts went the porter, went the pay, went the nights and the days. Every day the same, no change. In my arms you stir. A thousand street lamps flicker to light in the dusk. As I watch your eyes open, the reek of roasting hops knits a blanket of scent around us. I'm just going to take Linda and I have a mutual friend who's a writer as well, who always scolds me when I read that poem in a place where there isn't a pint of porter available for people. It's like, that's really unfair. You can't do that. The next poem is a Cork poem as well. And you'll see with my work that a lot of it speaks to connections between women and to the female body. And as such, I often feel like it's very important to say that I feel like one of the most important challenges facing Irish women now is a referendum on the Eighth Amendment. And I think that no Irish woman of childbearing age has been given a chance to speak, well, to speak, but to vote on abortion. And we're the people who have to deal with the bodily consequences. And I feel that that's wrong. And I want to read the next poem in honour of all my sister Irish women, and especially those who are right now travelling to or coming back from England. And I don't pretend to know what they're enduring, but I'm really ashamed that they can't be minded here. And we have a duty to mind our sisters and look after them. So this poem is called While Bleeding. In a vintage boutique on Sullivan's Quay, I lift a winter coat with narrow bodice, neat lapels, tight waist, a fallen hem. It is far too expensive for me, but the handwritten label 1915 brings it to my chest in armfuls of red. In that year, someone drew a blade through a bolt of fabric and stitched this coat into being. I carry it to the dressing room, slip my arms in. Silk lining spills against my skin. I clasp the belt and draw a slow breath as a cramp curls again where blood stirs and melts. In glass, I am wrapped in the weight of old red. Red pinched into girl cheeks and smeared from torn knees. Lipstick blotted on tissue. All the red bled into pads and rags. The weight of red. The weight for red that we share. In the mirror, the old coat blushes. This pocket may once have sheltered something precious. A necklace, a love letter, or a fresh egg, feather warm. Held gently so it couldn't crack, couldn't leak through seams, so it couldn't stain the dress within. The next one, I think artistically sometimes you can feel yourself needing to take a leap, and you can feel the writers who've gone before you that you draw inspiration from very strongly around you. And it's strange, sometimes the people that you don't expect are the people who come to you at moments like that. When I was in school, one of my favourite poems in our poetry textbook soundings was Austin Clark's Planter's Daughter. I love that poem so much. Can I read it to you? I know I'm supposed to just be reading my own poems, but I'm going to read that. And I'm sure you all know it very well, but I just love it so much. When night stirred at sea and the fire brought a crowd in, they say that her beauty was music in mouth, and few in the candlelight thought her too proud, for the house of the planter is known by the trees. Men that had seen her drank deep and were silent. The women were speaking wherever she went, as a bell that is rung or a wonder told shyly. And oh, she was the Sunday in every week. That line, and the fire brought a crowd in, I found myself really stuck on that line for a long time recently. And I want to share with you for the first time, which is always a kind of risky and difficult thing to do, a new poem that I have written that was sparked by that line, and the fire brought crowd in. And it made me think about that 4 year or 4 or 5 year period from 1919 when so many country houses were burnt. And I thought about the planter's daughter as I was reading about that. And this is the voicing of a planter's daughter. When night stirs in me, it brings no dream of sea, no quench, no liquid reprieve. No, night raises only the old roar, sets the stench of petrol spilling once more. Oh, night. How polite, the strangers who pushed me to choose heirlooms to send out to safety. How their smiles grew shaky when I chose only the front door key. Oh, home. In night damp grass, I stood alone. Men watched me from the lawn. I knew their mute gaze, grown grey, grown cold, as I knew all the women huddled on the gravel, the whispers they folded in their shawls. I turned from them and saw it begin, our windows brightening, lit one by one from within, cellar to hall to kitchen. How the ballroom shone. How the library blazed. If brigade bells sang, they sang in vain, for flames were already spilling up the drapes, erasing every hand and face from gilt frames, swiping china and ivory knives, slitting silks and fox fur cloaks, melting the grip of brooches from precious stones. Ghosts those flames racing up the stairs, sending smoke through slates, a constellation of sparks to star the dark. Oh, paraffin splash, oh, ash. When the eaves creaked, one boy looked to me. Shy grin turned jeer. Oh, the house of the thief is known by the trees. My back gleamed when I turned to leave. In my hand, I felt the key weep, turning a new keyhole. Now I may have no home of my own. I may be alone, but I am not meek. No, I am a stone released from old gold, shining, shining. And oh, I blaze a Sunday through every week. That's that. Thanks. I'm sure that's littered with historical inconsistencies, which you can all take me aside and explain the fine detail to me. History feels very close to me. And that runs through all of my books and through all of my poems. It's something that's brought me great comfort in rough times since I was a child even. And I was talking to my husband earlier about Dublinia. I remember going there when we were kids and being so struck by how real and how close history felt. And I think living in a place like Cork as well, you're constantly surrounded by the thrum of history. It feels so vibrant and like it's just there in the shadows, you know. I wrote this next poem last year during a rough time for our family. It's called In Albumen, In Pixels, In Bricks, and it's in three sections. One, in pregnancy, a woman carries a baby's ovaries like little fists on fallopian wrists. Inside each handful, a million oocyte cells, microscopic pips. In this, a mother is the eggshell that carries her descendants. Two. 2 weeks before Christmas, I am holding a string of silver tinsel when the phone rings. The landlord wants our home for his son. I drop the tinsel. He gives us a month. On supermarket shelves, my fingers hover over freckled eggs nestled in cardboard. Within each shell, chalazai threads, lustrous filaments that grip each membrane to its yellow orb, lifting each yolk up, holding it steady in its liquid glut. Three. I search websites for houses to rent, but everything is too dear for me. I distract myself with old photos instead. I click Evicted Family at Glen Bay, 1888, and find a shattered cabin, a man, a woman, four barefoot children. I peer at the girl's hands, but can't quite discern what she holds. A pale apron, perhaps, or a fistful of wool. Her hands exist only in pixels now. This girl who arrives by retina and optic nerve to live a while in my mind. I realise then what she holds in her hand. I recognise its freckled skin. I know its cargo of liquid, its chalazai grip. I know the gold that floats within. Thanks. And would anyone like another glass of wine? I'm really throwing you on an emotional roller coaster. Seriously, I won't be at all worried if anyone wants to go over and grab another glass. Help yourselves. We're living in very strange, I think, and curious times politically. The night of the American presidential election, I was in New York. And there was a strange electricity kind of almost in the air, you know. And when we landed back in Ireland, we found out that Trump had been elected, which was even more of a fright. So the next poem speaks to that, I think. The sense of, especially when we feel intimate with history, and as much as any person can be, I suppose, when you have that experience, it's so unsettling of watching things come round again. It's so frustrating and... oh, I don't know. Anyway, this is what I could write about that. At three, the child hankers after a distant past, a time of colossal, monstrous lives. We sigh and invite the long dead over our threshold again. We recite the old spells, whispering the difficult syllables that conjured them. Say, Spinosaurus. Pterodactyl, ichthyosaur, and they return, all dash and brawl. All it takes is a call to bring them back. The gorgeous Brontosaurus with its Audrey Hepburn grace, the bizarre prank arms of the T-Rex. Soon, no matter the plot of a new library book, whenever a hand happens upon an egg, we sense the thrust and nudge from was to is, the slow split of hole to hole, then poke and poke until a cold nose jabs out, followed by cold tooth and tail. The child slams the page, splutters, "Ha, told you, it's always the same." In his sleep, he smiles. We don't. In the dark, we stare at small screens and sigh. We can't close the book on that cold eye. Now, thank you. I think we are very tight, our screens. I had a bit of a row with Paula Meehan recently. because she was very much... she's very cross about how dependent we are on our screens, but I think it's a bit different from my generation. I think it's a great source of richness as well, and I can see a lot of that. And I suppose because we grew up with the internet, we maybe are a bit more comfortable with it. But she's so gas when she's talking about how when she looks around on the bus and everyone's just stroking. She's like, they're in, this is crazy. We have to go. They're just stroking screens. So I'm going to read two poems that are kind of related to our phones. An cé ceantá sé a scaoileann agus léi mé a scaoileann ar dúise, and I'll follow any Irish poem I read with an English translation. Gléach. This is a poem about Skype and how it allows us to have connections and to keep connections, which I see a lot, especially with my own generation, my own friends who are often abroad and with their kids and the grandparents, you know, and with relationships, trying to keep things going over Skype. We're so lucky to have it, but then at the same time, it doesn't feel real, you know. Gleach. Ní changlín, éin chóir de cuil, éin shrang telephone shin ní smó. I réim sin a rivery, ní higlum de ro a vrú ní sguire gom a chluas. Ní chlosham tú ag analú. Anish sé an lín a lag seo an tín chengal a wain atá fóc adrin. Agus titimid as a chéile. A rís is a ríst ela. Call. No slender thread. No telephone cord binds us anymore. Now that our computers call each other, I can't press your voice to my ear. No longer can I hear you breathe. Now we are bound only by this weak connection, and we break up and break up and break. The next poem is called Crackalure, which is a word that I only learned as I was researching this poem. It's the web of very fine cracks that develop on a painting surface as it ages. And I love that image of, like, I don't know if you'd see it here. These are very well kept paintings. So you'd see, like, that kind of web of cracks growing over over a painting. But they can, conservators can come and fix that now. And the other thing about this was how taken I am with when you meet someone and you see the screensaver that they have on their phone, because it tells you so much about a person. And so often, I know in my case, like, it's always some weird snapshot of the kids or something, and I'm always dropping and breaking phones, and when it smashes, like, it's so cool. Don't do it just to see how cool it is, but it's so cool. Like, this weird web of cracks will come up, and it's like weird ink leaks out. It's really cool. Next time I break a phone, come to me, I'll show you all. So this next poem is called Crackalure. Her tracksuit is pink velour, her earlobes prettily golden hooped, and she shivers as we all do in this dim bus queue. At 5:56, some glitch, some distraction, some finger twitch slips the phone from her grip and sends it smashing into the pavement. We all flinch. Soon the bus jolts us through streets and suburbs and into the dark. Night makes mirror of the window and makes me a spy. I sit behind her and pry. I watch her fingers slide over the fractured glass, jabbing its lattice of cracks where the clock's digits progress still in splintered italics, eclipsing a child's smile, his face grown suddenly lined. A little ink begins to leak up from the rifts. It grows dark. Oh, it grows dark and darker. Take us back, driver. Lurch this bus into reverse. As a conservator rewinds the lines from a painting's tempera eyes, take us back. Let her shiver, check the time, sigh at the child's smile, pick the phone up unharmed and slide it back in her pocket, its digits slipping to 5:59. The next poem is one that I wrote for my little girl, and things went very badly wrong at the end of our pregnancy, and both of us were in a lot of danger, unfortunately. I wrote a lot of this poem in fragments when I was on spinal morphine. So when I came around, I could find all these emails to myself with just, like, bizarre, like, words and things. So I took those fragments and tried to stick them together into this poem. And I want to dedicate it to all the women who are walking the corridors in Hollis Street and the Rotunda, and rather them than me right now. Call it a hospital, and it is. But call it a hive, and it splits into divisions where we become bees, hovering, nectar flecked. We flit and fizz and flicker through dawn dark corridors to the distant rooms of neonatal ICU. We are all bristling stitches, morphine drips, engorgements, limping to incubators clotted with knots of new. There, our breath is gas on glass, where small hands grasp at air. We wince when we sit by our infants, grimace over our weeping insides, our queried clots, our leaking gasps. At night, the hive pulses with the buzz of breast pumps, dull drone of rush and suck and rush and suck. We move through the hive on bruised wings, gripping files of yellow nectar. Below, In soft brood chambers, our young wait for us. We are a swarm of bees, of which I am only one, and you are another, my final child, my little girl of honey-spun tulle. I fill your ears with new words. Let my voice become the first to touch your spiraled cochlea. I say froth and cusp. I say rushed and blood. I tremble and say cloud and dandelion and plum. All night I goo and gaw in your sleeping ear, clumps of words spilling from me, a mess of morphine jumbled syllables. And oh my love, imagine all the floors above us that brim and buzz. Can you hear the chorus we have become? So there's only one, two. There's only two poems left. It's really important in a poetry reading to let people out of their misery and just give them two, just get through two and then more wine. So the next poem is kind of the opposite of a flirtation, but it has its own kind of strange desire working inside it, its own strange sort of lust, I suppose. And it's based in a pub in Cork City, which is called the Mutton Lane. And this poem is probably the longest title I've ever given a poem, so I'm going to have a drink of water first. It's called At 11:30 in the Mutton Lane Inn, I am fire, slaughter, dead starlings. Though this pub is packed with bodies, a shifting mass of limbs and laughter, I feel your gaze on me. It burns. I know what you'll say, you've said it before, that you don't care about my silver ring, that tomorrow morning you want us to be lying together still in your attic room up on the tallest city hill where windows tilt open to let starling song fly in. We have resisted long enough, you'll say. No, we can resist some more. If you come closer, I'll keep my gaze on the floor. I'll say, in 1622, on the last day of May, a lightning cloud shadowed this city. Its sparks flared on thatch and pulsed to flame. People stumbled over each other through the narrow laneways, clutching children to their chests. Lightning and fire bloomed along the paths where they ran and fell and ran. Many suffocated in flames as it ate air. Still, I can feel your stare. If you come closer, I'll say, after that fire, those who survived spoke of the omen of a fortnight before, when two murmurations of starlings clashed in the sky, flinging themselves at each other until small corpses thumped into gutters by the dozen and ripped wings cobbled the streets, leaving the paths all bird-bloodied. For hours, those birds' tiny magnet hearts jerked towards each other as though they couldn't help themselves in shiver and grasp and shatter, their bodies swooning and falling into each other, 1,000 small deaths. Except, listen, in those days, they didn't call them starlings, they called them stairs. So you see, I will say, stairs spark fires that cannot be quenched. Turn away, I will say. Find someone else. Tom Concrete Nulikan Oscailin. I'm just going to read my last poem as one in Irish. and I'll read it in English then. I know it's risky to follow a poem about a pub called the Mutton Lane in with a poem about mother-in-laws. Okay, so I'm going to follow this risky path. This poem is a poem that I wrote for fun. And I always make a point of saying before I read it that it's an amalgamation of all the mother-in-laws I've ever known. It's not about one woman in particular. You would be totally mistaken if you were to think that. So it's a curse, but it's a very tongue-in-cheek curse. Malacht. Guím mohar chéile art, a chocach majan dauné gan chnaga. Le slach de chur ar de chach, maris kiart. A lagoch na téide duan ala a rausín ar gach bala, a curt do stála a lum lúba, is í a canna tún le jóni in ór de cín is a gocha. A ágach gach siomra, sciobha scúpa, círa cúrha na duan ala cailta, an tír tiov le gionil míl tóga ar fa seachtana in a díag. Mo hrí valacht ert, mor chéle mar seo, ja vesa is balvacht. I can always tell how many people who speak Irish are in a room. Yeah, because there's always like, if I read in a place where Mata Long Gwail Gorian, Bagatan Plix Gamakagora, but when there aren't that many people who speak Irish or are unsure, there's just like deathly silence after the curse. I wish you a mother-in-law who would saunter up on a Sunday morning without knocking to tidy your home as it should be done correctly. A woman who'd swipe at the cobwebs that dangle dance on every wall, her feather duster jigging, a wild roller coastering, and she would be singing shrill and free, Joni Mitchell probably. I wish you this woman who'd leave every room spick and span, immaculate, every spider squished, leaving the air thick with whining houseflies for weeks. A triple curse. May you be jinxed with a mother-in-law like this. With sorry, ladies. With impeccable manners and a buttoned lip. Gormila Mahogany.
Just to thank Darren, thank you very much. I know Darren would be happy to chat to you if you have any questions as well after. And that clasp is available, isn't it?
Anywhere
on the internet or in most good bookshops too. Yeah. So thank you very much, Darren. That was brilliant.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you.